Good afternoon. Hard to believe we're on day four already and we only have one more left. I don't know how you feel, but I'm not quite sure I'm ready for this to end. It's been so much fun. And I really enjoyed that song. I know it's not our theme song, but it's a beautiful prayer. It's a beautiful thought expressing prayer. And you know, I had to think, I told Jonathan after he came and sat down, I just so love your choir sessions. I get so inspired, and I know you're rehearsing, so you only sing part of the songs, which bugs me to death. I just want to finish them. I have such a hard time not going to the end when you get going. That's the only thing I really don't like about rehearsal, but I know it's necessary, so it's okay. But the power of those messages, the inspiration that comes through from singing, I don't know if you realize the power that is there. I told Jonathan, I think it's some of the most powerful messages that get preached here all day because of the expression. And you know, I watched that, and I want to encourage the young people because I want to talk about music a little bit later on a bit. But my favorite place to sing in the whole world is, it's not Grand Central, Broadway Junction. In Brooklyn, New York. It's a subway station on the J train in Brooklyn. Any of you ever been there? All right, I got a few of you. Isn't that just an awesome place to sing? The acoustics are incredible. It's all hard tile, as all those subway stations are, but it's not that big. And I don't know, just the shape of that room is perfect for singing. And I've been there a number of times with groups, and you stand there and sing These old familiar hymns that we sing on a Sunday morning, take for granted and don't think about it. But there in that context, those songs take on, I don't know, some kind of a new life. And in that particular subway station, there's many of them in New York, and they're all fun to sing in, they're all fun to witness in. But in that particular subway station, there's a lot of work traffic. People that are simply transiting through from work, and it's a lot of immigrants, a lot of what most of our society would consider middle to lower class people. And so many times I've watched them come through, not knowing we're going to be there, and they're walking by, and they hear those hymns, and they'll stop, they'll back into a corner maybe, they don't want to make themselves, and shortly tears are coming down their eyes. And you know something's going on in the heart. And I watched Brother Daniel Pollard, he's not there anymore, but he used to be one of the ministers up at Followers of Jesus there in Brooklyn, the BMA church. And Daniel would watch for those. He'd stand in a corner, and Daniel himself was an immigrant from, I forget which country, I want to say Dominican, but I'm not sure that's right, one of the Caribbean countries. And but he'd stand there and he'd watch these people, and when he'd see that happening, the power of the singing beginning to touch their hearts, he'd just walk over to them, put an arm around them and say, "Can I pray about something in your life with you?" And you wouldn't believe how many times that would bring a new opening of the heart. And they'd share something with him. And he'd pray heaven down on them right there standing in that subway station. And it all started with the power of the message, the music. I just like to inspire all of you as you consider it. You hold that power in your hands. And God bless you for the effort you're putting into learning to sing well here this week. And I can't wait for Sunday night, but I told you that already. All right, so a couple of things that I should address here in opening up. First of all, I said Enoch was the only person that ever got off the face of this earth alive. And I think I was wrong. Who else? Yeah, thank you. Forgot about him. So I'm very human too. See, and somebody came to me afterwards and says, "What about Elijah? I forgot about him." So you're right. I think it was just those two, I think. But if you think of someone else, I'd still like to stand corrected. And also, the time span of the Bible, we talked about that 2 days ago. And then I forgot to address it yesterday. Anybody go look it up? I guess you all didn't have a chance. Well, I did. The 1600 is a reasonable figure. And I know that the 1600 was stuck in my mind from studying material from CLP, Christian Light Publishers. And they've published that figure in some of their Bible study classes, and that's where I would have had it. But I went and looked at the source historical facts for it, and it is there. There's debate about which book is the oldest, but it's either Genesis or Job. And scholars generally agree that it was likely in the neighborhood of 1400. Most of them are putting it around 1450, and likely Genesis being the first book written, likely by Moses. So there's things there we can't know for sure. And the entire New Testament was written, I think, starting about 20 A.D. up to 95 A.D. So that's a period of what, 70 years, 65, 70 years, 75. And so that's the extent of the Bible back to 1450. So altogether, that's going to give you, that's 1550. So we're in the neighborhood of 1600 years. I did see one scholar that said he thinks it's 2000, but I couldn't understand his logic. So, you know, there is some question about it. It's not an absolutely defined thing, but it does seem to be at least 1600 years. And like we said the other day, the Bible agrees with itself from beginning to end. You can harmonize all of it. That's a miracle. And that's pretty amazing. So I wanted to address those two things. And then, I know I left you in Hebrews yesterday, and maybe we'll get back to Hebrews, but I'm really hoping today to spend the bulk of our time talking about practical things in your lives, and how do we take this faith that we've been talking about, this faith that works, this faith that is real in your life, this faith that is something you stand on, and figure out how to inform everything you do in your life. What are the actions that should flow out as we engage faith in a practical way? And that's where I'd like to spend today. So, first of all, to deal with a couple of the questions that you put in the box, and I thank you for your questions. There were some really good ones in there. I'm going to tell you ahead of time, I'm not addressing all of them here today, because a few of them, between Mark and I, we decided they'd be great questions for the panel on Sunday. So some of you, if I don't have your question here today, there's at least three or four that we put into the Sunday box. You'll get them answered on Sunday, because we really want to engage practical questions there too. And of course, we're looking for more yet, I think, from what Brother Mark said, so keep putting them in there. But you would like them by tonight if possible, right, Brother Mark? All right. So, but seriously, give us your questions. What are the things that you wonder about and you wish you could ask? This is your opportunity. And you know what? We welcome skepticism. I know one young man when I went to Bible school, and he didn't have a good attitude, but he said, you know, my favorite pastime is to nail the preachers to the wall and watch them wiggle. I could tell you who that young man is, and you'd actually probably know his name today. I'm not going to do that. And I hope none of you are here with that kind of an attitude. But if you are, still bring your questions. If it's really out of line or something that's ridiculous, we'll ignore it. But if it's something legitimate that you wrestle with, we'd really like to engage those questions. So I had a question that came in related to some of the things we talked about Monday and touched on Tuesday. And the question was this: how would you respond to what skeptics call, and it's what I assume be skeptics of the creation story and of biblical narrative and of God as a whole, to what skeptics call an argument from incredulity? Now, how many of you know what that means? All right, good. I got just a couple of hands. I was pretty sure that I had an idea, but I felt like I needed to go look it up to make sure. And I was right in what I thought. And this is certainly a valid question. And skeptics are going to throw that at you as a Christian sometimes, because you're going to say, I just can't see how evolution could possibly be true, and therefore, I don't think it is. That's an argument from incredulity. It can work two ways. I can't imagine how X could be true, and honestly, this can work both ways. I would postulate that there's a lot of people on the evolution side of the argument that are going to do exactly the same thing about creationism. They're going to say, I can't see how creationism could possibly be true. It's fantastic. How could it be? Well, logically, it can't. It's going to take faith to believe it. So therefore, if I can't see how it could, it can't be true. That's an argument from incredulity. It also can take a form that I can't imagine how something could be false. Got to be true, so it's got to be true. Well, and you know what I say? Doesn't matter what I think, and it really doesn't matter what you think. So whether I find it incredulous or not is beside the point. What matters is what the facts really are. Now, we all have to interpret the facts, But the fact that these things are often given as a basis for establishing truth is not a good one. And even our Bible says, let God be true and every man a liar. And you know, we wrestle with truth and we try to understand what truth is. And we all do need to understand truth to the best of our ability for our own lives. Paul says in Romans 14, to be convinced of the things that you believe for yourself. Be convinced in your own conscience. And I believe it's a duty of every Christian to carefully analyze. Remember, we talked about that yesterday as part of choosing. Carefully consider, carefully look at, carefully weigh. You can't just frivolously not look. And carefully decide how you ought to live. However, just because I can't imagine something or I believe something doesn't make it true or false. Now, I want to go to a few things. So one of the best known atheists is Richard Dawkins. How many of you recognize that name? All right, I figured. He's probably one of the most published atheists in our world today. He's still alive. He's got to be 83, I think. And as far as I know, still just as strong of an atheist as he ever has been. And guess what? Not to my surprise, he started out as an Anglican Christian. He was raised in an Anglican home. He's also a British, I think he's a biologist, the same as Charles Darwin was, who wrote the Theory of Evolution. I can't remember what that book is called, but in 1850, about 1840-something. And so, I don't know, Britain's not giving us good stuff on all of this, but it's okay. Richard Dawkins, though, made this statement, and I want you to listen to this in light of thinking about this argument from incredulity. This is his statement. Evolution is a fact. It is beyond reasonable doubt. It is beyond serious doubt. It is beyond sane, informed, intelligent doubt. Don't you love all those adjectives? It is beyond doubt. Evolution is a fact. Evolution is a fact, and my book will demonstrate it. No reputable science disputes it, and no unbiased reader will close the book doubting it. So evolution is true. Now, I'd like to say, and Richard Dawkins should be smart enough to know, but that's an argument from incredulity. Those statements are not true. And there is fact to disprove those statements. And so, and it's unfortunate today, and you as young people get a tsunami of information coming your way out there in the world that makes you believe that, you know, 95 or 98 or 99% of scientists all agree this is how things are, these are the facts. And unfortunately, a lot of things get ignored in that whole process. Now, I'll never have as many brain cells as Richard Dawkins, so the man's brilliance is high. But the things that I have to process and that I have to consider, even of the things he says, I have to look at it on its face and what makes sense. Now, of course, for me, there's a lot of things that I see, but I'm far from the smartest man in all this. There is an organization, and I think they're headquartered out in Washington State, that has made it their business to try and give a voice to scientists who don't buy into the normal theory of evolution, which has been commonly accepted in recent times in most of our social circles. But I found some really interesting things that they have compiled. And I can't read all of this, but according to what Dawkins is saying there, if you reject evolution, you're unintelligent, your sanity should be questioned. And he proclaims that no reputable science disputes it, and the scientists will dispute it. In 2006, there was a poll that was done by the Lewis Finkelstein Institute for Social and Religious Research that found that 60% of American medical doctors reject Darwinism. Now, why do you think that might be? And this is pretty interesting. But they're stating that they do not believe that humans evolved through natural processes alone. 38% of the American medical doctors that were polled agreed with the statement that humans evolved naturally with no supernatural involvement, which would be full evolution theory. The study also reported that one-third of all medical doctors favor the theory of intelligent design over evolution. The other third in between would have been trying to do some combination of the two, but didn't agree with full evolution. So it's not fair to say what Dawkins is saying. It's not true. There was also another man, Dr. Jerry Bergman, who was a scientist, and he compiled a list of about 3,000 Darwin skeptics, including about a dozen Nobel Prize winners. And these were men who were willing to sign their names, but he said he has a private list of about 1,000 more persons who don't want their names on a public list because they have real concerns about possible retaliation or harm to their careers. Now, what's up with that? Is this objectivity in science? If we've got a scientist that says, you know, this is my position, but don't tell anyone, it might hurt my career. I'm telling you, there's something else going on in science when we have this stuff happening. And it's perfectly reasonable to ask the questions, what is that? As of May 2021, which is 2 years ago, the list had been signed by about 1,213 scientists who agree with the following statement. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination for the evidence of Darwinian theory should be encouraged. So that's a lot of scientists. I'm not saying they're all creationists or all Christians, but all of them are saying, you know what, there's problems over here with this theory. So I'm saying forgive this poor simple fellow for asking and saying, is there a reason that we should question this theory? And I think we must. Now, it wasn't just Christians. It is true that it's definitely a majority of people coming from a Christian perspective that spearhead the opposition to evolution. But I found another thing that was terribly interesting, and this is published in The Guardian. The Guardian is a left-leaning publication. If you want to get cutting-edge left-leaning stuff, you can read it in The Guardian. And this was published last June 28th of 2022. And the title of it is, Do We Need a New Theory of Evolution? This is not from a Christian perspective, okay? A new wave of scientists argues that the mainstream evolutionary theory needs an urgent overhaul. Their opponents have dismissed them as misguided careerists, and the conflict may determine the future of biology. As strange as it sounds, scientists still do not know the answers to some of the basic questions about how life on Earth evolved. Take eyes, for instance. Think about these doctors. Take eyes, for instance. Where do they come from exactly? The usual explanation of how we got these stupendously complex organs rests upon the theory of natural selection. You may recall the gist from school biology lessons, and if you've been a public school student, this is what you will have been taught. If a creature with poor eyesight happens to produce offspring with slightly better eyesight, thanks to random mutations, then that tiny bit more vision gives them more chance of survival. The longer they survive, the more chance they have to reproduce and pass on the genes that equip them with slightly better eyesight. Some of their offspring might, in turn, have better eyesight than their parents, making it likelier that they too will reproduce, and so on. And that is natural selection. And I'm going to tell you, natural selection is a real thing. Natural selection does happen. But natural selection does not necessarily require the millions of years that evolutionists claim it does. Every farmer who is a good farmer understands natural selection. Many of the plant varieties, you know, around here in Lancaster County, you've got corn now that produces over 300 bushels an acre every year on a very regular basis, maybe 350 by now. And you know what? We got there by natural selection. So that's a real thing. But it doesn't mean... So now listen on. And so on. Generation by generation. And here's the problem. Over unfathomably long periods of time, tiny advantages add up. And eventually, after a few hundred million years, you have creatures who can see as well as humans or cats or owls. This is the basic story of evolution as recounted in countless textbooks and pop science bestsellers. The problem, according to a growing number of scientists, is that it is absurdly crude and misleading. For one thing, it starts midway through the story, taking for granted the existence of light-sensitive cells, lenses, and irises, without explaining where they came from in the first place. Nor does it adequately explain how such delicate and easily disrupted components mesh together to form a single organ. And it isn't just eyes that the traditional theory struggles with. The first eye, the first wing, the first placenta that nourished a baby. How they emerge. Explaining these things is the foundational motivation of evolutionary biology, says Armin Mazek, a biologist at Indiana University, and yet we still do not have a good answer. This classic idea of gradual change, one happy accident at a time, has fallen flat. Now, this isn't a preacher saying these words. This is a secular scientist who is saying, I look at the facts and there is stuff here that doesn't add up. I could read a lot more of this, but there was this group of scientists in 2015 spearheaded an effort to actually change the narrative of evolution. And that's why the title of this article, Do We Need a New Theory of Evolution? And try and interject some ideas that could be put into our textbooks to alter the traditional theories of evolution. And they got shot down. The mainstream of scientific thought said, no way. And I wish I could find their quote. I can't find it right now. But their fear was that altering the narrative is going to undercut the credibility of the theory as a whole. And so these group of scientists who are saying, we got problems here, they're saying, you know, go away and be quiet. Don't talk about them because we've got to uphold evolution as a whole. And I'm saying, excuse me, what kind of science is this? So I'm just saying all of that to tell you this thing about arguments of incredulity is a real thing, but it applies both ways. And for me, it comes down to this, just a couple of simple things. When I look at creation, I see complexity. I is a tremendously good example, but you can go look all over the place, just every which way you look, and you will find complexity that cannot be explained easily, or at least I can't find explanations for it. And so Brother Stewart back here can speak to some of this much more than I. He's got a lot of information on it. And but you can't explain it. I see order. I see the way all of creation works in order. And that order also is not explained satisfactorily through these processes of natural selection. And then I also see beauty in it. So I'm seeing beauty, I'm seeing complexity, and I'm seeing order. And I don't see beauty explained through natural selection either. And I told you about the trees the other day. You know, why does an oak tree turn a dark red? Why does, and I guess we're not supposed to ask these questions, but random chance? I mean, it's preposterous to believe. So these are the things. Yes, I'm incredulous about this working. And you're welcome to be incredulous about the creation narrative, but I'm going to tell you at the end of the day, as a matter of faith for you and I, it comes down to this. Am I going to believe there's a God in heaven who created this? Am I going to believe that Genesis 1 is real and meaningful for my life? Or am I going to have to rewrite all that into something that I can somehow be comfortable with? And I'm going to posit. Now, this is my theory, okay? So this is Carl telling you why I think. I believe the reason we have all these conflicts in greater science as much as we do, and it affects us in many, many ways, much more than just the theories of evolution or creationism. But I believe it's because so many of these scientists start from a social standpoint of not being able to risk the reality that there could be a God in this picture. And I think it comes down to a personal issue. Because if there's a God, then what? I have to be accountable to that God. If there's a God and there's any possibility that this book is true, whoa, it means big things for my life. And so I can't go there. Now that's my opinion and my theory about why these scientists have such a hard time being truly honest about it all. So for what it's worth. But I look at all of that, and for me, the question gets settled. And I'll keep looking. I'll tell you honestly, I'll keep looking. Evidence, creation science and evolutionary science fascinates me all the time. And so I'll keep looking, but I am very doubtful that I'm going to find anything that ties it together on the other side in a clear way. So for me, I accept that God is real. I accept that Scripture was given by God to us. I accept the Genesis account of creation, and I'm building my life on that. And I'm willing to debate anyone, anywhere, anytime, to the greatest extent of my knowledge. And when I run out of knowledge, I'll certainly refer them to men like Stuart and others who can go way beyond me scientifically. Okay? But it's out there. Let's look at the facts. All right. Enough of that. Any more? I don't know who gave me that question, but did we answer it good enough? I hope. So faith should call us to seek for truth. Then there was a practical question that came in, and this completely turns the corner. But this is a practical question that I think has an interesting perspective to it. And the question was this: why do young men get married when a mother is a widow? And I think it means their mother. And maybe it would be, should young men get married when their mother is a widow? Or is it appropriate for a young man to get married if their mother is a widow? And that's an interesting thing to think. And I hope that I'm interpreting the question accurately. But here's where I believe it's going. So a mother that's a widow is going to need somebody to support her, correct? And so if there's a young man who's part of that home and he feels a responsibility to support his mother as a widow, should he get married and find someone else to support? And what happens to his mother in that case? I'm assuming that's underlying the question. But regardless, let's look at the principles of it. And how does faith inform something like that? Well, we'll talk more about this later, but one of the clear scriptural principles we have, because faith is going to act out of a premise of trying to understand what is God's rules, what is God's way, what is God's order, and we're going to apply that test to every question that we face. So here's this question: how does God speak to this? And one of the first things we find is that it is the responsibility of a son to show honor towards his father or mother. And it's very definitely in place for a widow to show honor, respect, love, compassion, and gentleness. And incidentally, a lot of those intersect with the fruit of the Spirit, right? So you're a faith-filled person. You're trying to live out of godliness in your life. Well, the fruit of the Spirit should be part of it. So all that is there. But Paul gives some very specific instructions about widows also. And he says, especially for younger widows, let them marry. If they're older widows and they truly have a need, and he gives a list of classifications, he says, let the church receive them. Now, let me ask you this. This situation where there's a widow and a son isn't the young man's fault, is it? He didn't cause it. Probably wouldn't have chosen it. But sometimes we find ourselves in these difficult situations, and life brings a dilemma our way. What do we do? And so it brings up a valid question. But we still have Genesis 2, where God lays out clearly how he fulfilled Genesis 1 when he created humans, male and female. It says, created he them in the image of God. And behold, it was very good. And I often love to ask this question, just to prickle your brains a little bit. Is God a man or is he a woman? Because it says, in the image of God created he them, male and female, in his image. It's one of my favorite studies when we get into, and I'll talk about marriage a little bit later, but when we get into looking at God's design for marriage, and I love to go through this with young couples, and we look at God's design for marriage, and we look at how God made men and women different, and we look at the attributes that he put, and both of them are a reflection of God. And I think it's good for us to think about that. Good for us to understand that you are created in his image. So anyway, that was a delicious little bunny trail there. But the fact that that we have Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 still in play when this situation unfolds for this young man has to be considered. Now, at the end of Genesis 2, after it gives the account of how God created Eve and he brought her to Adam, Adam realized his loneliness, and he says, you know, in all the world, there's no one for me. And God created Eve and brought her to him. Incredibly beautiful story there. And it says at the end of that, that for this cause, because of this design, a young man should leave his father and mother and should be joined unto his wife, and they too shall be one flesh. It is God's plan. Now, does that mean that everybody has to get married? No. Does that mean that God never has a plan and a purpose for somebody who doesn't find a marriage partner? Absolutely not. There are fulfilling callings that God gives to single people as well. But it is God's will that the majority of people live inside that Genesis 2 plan that He created for the whole human race. And it is exactly how procreation and some of His mandates to humanity in relation to the earth are going to be fulfilled in the context of marriage and homes that reflect who God is. More on that later. So, we've got these competing priorities, if you will. We've got the responsibility to honor and filial duty that the young man would have towards his wife, his mother, the care and compassion, but we also have this mandate from God for how He ordered the human race. What should we do? And I'd like to say, we're going to face this type of dilemma in other areas of our lives. Now, I'm going to say do both. Do both. And I believe it's very possible to do. And I don't think we should live in an either-or situation and put God in a box that way, because God has both as a priority. And if you apply your heart to keep yourself open to God in that way, you're going to find a path through that you can do both. Don't ignore mom. Don't turn your back on her. Don't let her. But there's many ways, and frankly, my own experience has seen many times, there's more than one sibling often, so that burden of support can be spread around. Church can often step in and help. So it doesn't all have to fall on one young man. It can be spread around. That widow needs to be cared for. And if she's a younger widow, probably she can remarry, and it solves some of that issue. So I'm saying keep a heart open to God and look for God's will in fulfillment of all of His principles. Does that make sense? And apply that concept anytime you face a dilemma like that. That would bring question to a situation. And once again, I do not like the clock. We have 25 minutes. All right, so thinking of the practical actions of faith. Listen, young people, here's what it comes down to. When you have locked into the things we looked at yesterday, you've made the choice. You've made the commitment. You've committed to loyalty. And now you're looking for ways to live that out in your life. The action of faith. It actually comes down to simply saying, how can I be a good image bearer for my God here on this earth? How can I bear His image? How can I reflect Him accurately to a world about me? How can I live in a way that people can look at my life and they can see God in me? And we have so many different ways we characterize this. And often we say, does the world see Jesus in you? Do they see that you love Him? Can they see by the way you live? And it's kind of all saying the same thing. But how can you be an accurate image bearer of God Himself? I think Brother Wilmer mentioned this morning, 1 Corinthians 5:17, from self-expression to God reflection is what I call that transformation. And that verse is one of my favorite ones, although I've got so many, so that's probably not a good thing to say. It's a favorite verse, but it is. If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. How does it happen? This is also the new birth. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. There's a selfish set of values, which is what you'll find the world lives in all around us. And 1 John 2:15 describes it so well. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, they're not of the Father, but they're of the world. And it's all about me. It's about what feels good. It's what pushes me up the ladder. It's what brings me people's attention. It's all about me. It's selfish. And that is what you're going to find in this world about us. And when we choose Christ, when we make that choice of faith to follow Him, to be a disciple of Jesus, well, we shift. All of that goes away. And behold, all things are become new. And what do we get? A set of kingdom values. Whichever speaker, I can't remember, mentioned that this morning about kingdom values. We get that whole set of kingdom values that we exchange for the self-expression that we used to have. And so look through your lives and take inventory of how you're living and what the things are in your life that is expressing who you are on a daily basis. Is it you or is it God? And if you're honest, you're going to know the answers to those questions most of the time. Now, Paul gives us a really curious verse. And we could preach for a whole hour on this verse. 1 Timothy 4:12, it says, "Let no man despise your youth, but be thou an example of the believers." And then he says, "In word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith and purity." And he gives those categories of things. And Paul there is giving that word to Timothy. And we don't know how old Timothy was, but I think he was pretty close to some of your ages, at least, from everything I've been able to study, in the neighborhood of 20 to 22, 23, somewhere in there. And again, there could be some variation, but it doesn't matter. Timothy was a young man, and Paul was giving him this charge. And he says, don't let somebody despise your youth. Now, why would he use those words? It's because youth is generally not thought of as a time of maturity, right? And Brother Wilmer's tired of me saying that he's a holy man that you can look up to, but I believe that he is. And I told him today I'm going to take it the next level and I'll get another rebuke here. But Brother Wilmer is a saint. Did you know that? That word saint is all through our New Testament. And we got to stop being scared of that word. He's my fellow saint. And I love Brother Wilmer. And all of you are called to be Brother Wilmer's fellow saints. But what if all of you as young people aspire to that? You know, he's not a super spiritual person, and that's why he gets tired of me saying that. But he's lived a long time. He's learned how to walk. He's learned how to experience the things he's been teaching you here this week. But you young people can get a hold of these concepts by faith, by choosing, by saying, "I will commit," by saying, "I will be loyal." And you too can become a person who reflects God's glory and is not someone who is despised. Now, contrarily, most youth today, and I can tell you story after story of how this works, but you can think of them yourselves. Most youth today who live kind of selfishly, and they live the way all the rest of the world is around them, at best it's a mediocre life. At best it's something to kind of be tolerated until they grow up, and we hope they get past this youthful stuff, and someday maybe they'll mature and settle down. Paul says, nonsense. Do not let people despise your youth. But young people, be an example of God's people in all these areas of your life. And you know, I've often said the young people are a barometer to the temperature of any church. And I believe that's true. But I believe it ought to be that you as young people are out in front, if you will, of the rest of the congregation. Us older people, the more gray hair we get, the tireder we get. Right, Wilmer? Okay? So we have a handicap, if you will, at this thing. We might have experience. We've learned some lessons the hard way, a lot of them. And that's helped us to know how things ought to be. But you young people can take the mistakes we've made, learn from them, latch hold of these concepts, put your youthful energy into it, and you can accomplish things that are going to be beyond any of us. Would God give us churches that are full of youth like that? You can do it. I'd love to talk about all of those things because there's power in every one of them. In the words that you speak, does the world see Jesus in you? In conversation, which in our English language would mean words also. King James doesn't. It means in the lifestyle that you live. As the world sees you living every day, the places you go, the music you listen to, the friends that you have, the entertainment that you have in your life, in your conversation of your life, does it reflect God or does it reflect self? In charity, in love, it's going to start right at home in the closest of your relationships. Doesn't end there, but that's where it starts. Your home, your relationships with your siblings, your mother and father, and then extending out from there your friends. Is your heart a channel of love? Love that is doing what's good for the other person? Love that is giving of itself to others? In spirit, do you have a soft spirit? Do you have a teachable spirit? Do you have a heart that says, "God, I want to do your will. Show me." Or do you have a heart that says, "I want to be a Christian, but I want to do it my way. Or maybe someday, but not now." Are your hands like this? Or are they like this? What is your spirit? You know, people can see that. You don't have to be around someone real long until you can sense where their spirit is at. Where is your spirit? And then in faith, of course, we're talking about faith all week, so you know what that means. Where do you stand in relation to your choice, to your commitment, to your loyalty? Are you an example of the believers? Or are you living for self? And finally, in purity. And oh, that one. It's been mentioned a number of times. But it's so important. And it applies to both sides. Is your life an example of God in the purity of your heart? And I'm telling you, it can be. But you must choose. You must commit. You must be loyal. So I'm going to let those things there. Again, we could preach for a long time on them, but I'd like to talk about a few more practical issues for just the remainder of our time here today. And there's many things we could, but I mentioned music, and I'd love to engage on that one. I wish that I had the time to have every one of you give me a clip or a piece of your favorite piece of music. And I'm not talking about the one that you... I'm talking about the one you listen to when you're in the car driving down the road and nobody else is with you. That's the one I want to know. And I'd like to listen to it together. And I'd like to ask the question, so is this something that feeds and expresses self? Or is this something that lifts your spirit to God and reflects God for who He is? And I honestly believe most of you, if you get honest in the quiet of your hearts about this, are going to know the answer to that question. You don't need me to help you. But this world of music today is handicapping so many young people. And the reason is because it's so widely available. You know, again, when I grew up, I told you the most modern thing we had was cassette tapes. I still remember the old vinyl records. In fact, I think we have a collection of them at home yet that I rescued that didn't get thrown out. There's a lot of pretty nice music on some of those old records. But we had to work to listen to music a bit. And today you've got music so readily available on all of your electronic devices and everywhere. And here's the thing. Your parents and your preachers might have some things that they want to give direction in your life. But you know what? You're going to have to choose to submit to those things. Because there is no possible way that your preachers or even your parents are going to be able to fully police your life to make sure that you're not crossing those lines and getting into trouble with these things. And I know so many young people today that are living double lives. And I also know parents that say, don't tell me, I don't even want to look. And I go home and cry about both of those because it is not the will of God. And it's one of the reasons that we've got young people that are struggling so much in their spiritual lives today. Did you know music both expresses and it feeds your spirit? You're going to play the kind of music in your car that reflects who you are inside. And if you know that your music is on the edge and has some carnality to it, you've got to turn around and look inward because that music is there. You're enjoying that music because of something in your heart that likes that music. But at the same time that music expresses what's in your heart, it also feeds that in you. And so this carnality builds, and this is a cycle that builds. And the music usually doesn't stay static. You'll move from one thing to the next, and you may get to a point that you say, you know, how in the world did I get here? But did you know music, I probably don't have to tell some of you this, you know this, because you're in it, you're in these traps. But music is as addictive as many other things that can be addictive to you. Is your music sanctified? When we're talking about living out faith in a practical way, you've got to ask yourselves these questions. And I would love to talk about why music is spiritual, but there's some actually really good examples in the Bible that show us that. Do you remember how David played for Saul when Saul had an evil spirit that came over him? And he couldn't shake the evil spirit. And they called David to come and play with his harp. And when David came and played with his harp, the evil spirit left. Remember that? Music has spirits, my dear young people and brothers and sisters. Music has spirits. And I've watched it in Africa. I've watched it in Haiti. There's a reason that these witch doctors, and I think it was Brother Roger talked about that one of the first days, there's a reason that these witch doctors use music to go along with their incantations when they're calling down the evil spirits. There's many a night that I had to lay there in the mission house in Elmina and listen to that music. And it's crazy music. It's got a heavy beat to it. I mean, to me, it doesn't sound nice. I don't know if it sounds nice to them or not, but they're using that music as a means to invoke these spirits to come. And I'm telling you, young people, when you play with these different kinds of music today, there's a spirit that's in that music. What is it? Are you connecting with God? Or are you connecting with something that comes from the spirit of this world? And the vast majority of music that's out there today is not of God. Now, I'm going to tell you, you can go to Pandora? What's the one I have? I don't know. I can't remember. You all are going to know what all the platforms are where you can get music. But almost all of them are going to have enough good music. If you seek it out, you can find it. But it's probably still going to be a couple of percent of all the music that's on there. And so if you allow yourself to engage in the world's music, you're going to have to do some serious considering of what you're going to listen to. So music is a moral issue. Music is spiritual. And from a faith perspective, thinking about the actions of faith, you simply got to ask the question, does my music glorify God? And does it inspire my heart to love Him more, or does it feed my flesh? And I'm just going to let it there. You ask yourself that question. And if you find yourself compromised on any of these things, like I said yesterday, look, just humble your heart before God this week and say, God, you know what? I want to clean this area of my life up. He will help you. You can even get out of an addiction. Some are harder than others, but you can do it. All right? I want to talk a little bit more here about following God's design for relationships. And I know this one has been mentioned numerous times this week by different speakers. I know Wilmer's hit it, I've heard Roger hit it, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier. But this thing of relationship with your parents and honoring father and mother, and how a faith commitment is going to inform the way you live. And the reason you're hearing it multiple times is because it is so foundational, it is so important, it is so real in the way it should inform how you young people are going to live your lives. And I want to just read to you. And just like in this whole thing of evolution, we got to look at the facts. So you're committing yourself here to be a Christian. You're committing yourself to follow God. You're committing yourself to do things His way. What is His way? Exodus 20, verse 12, which is the Ten Commandments. And Brother Wilmer's been preaching law, but the law shows us God's will. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And Brother Wilmer's also been showing how the grace of the New Testament takes away the burden of the law, but actually lifts us to an even higher level of living out that holiness and godliness that God was trying to show in the way He wanted His people to live in the law of the Old Testament. So there it was. God gave it. Honor thy father and mother. Deuteronomy 5:16. Honor thy father and mother as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. Why? So that thy days may be prolonged and that it may go well with thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. So it's just Old Testament, right? Matthew 15:4. Jesus, for God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother. And he that curseth father and mother, let him die the death. There's a little more context around that. But that what Jesus was underscoring there came right out of that law of the Old Testament. Matthew 19. Jesus again. And this was the rich young ruler coming to Jesus and saying, what do I have to do to gain eternal life? He said, keep the commandments. Which? Jesus said, you shouldn't kill. Thou shalt do no murder. Okay, score. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Score. Thou shalt not steal. Score. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Score. And here's this, right in that list. Honor thy father and mother. Along with not murdering, not committing adultery, not stealing, and not bearing false witness. And then he says, love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, that young man said, I've done all these things from my youth up. What lack I yet? You know the rest of that story. But my point is, Jesus said, honor your father and mother right there in the rest of that list. And then Paul in Ephesians 6, which somebody read this earlier. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for it's right. For this is right. Honor thy father and mother. For this is, which is the first commandment with promise. What's the promise? That thou mayest live long on the earth. That it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. Now, I didn't write the book, young people. These are God's. This is God's words, okay? Roger said when we've got clear scripture, we can thunder. I hope I'm not thundering, but I want to drive this home into your hearts. God wrote the book. He made the rules. My responsibility is just to help you understand what they are. Webster's defines honor as this. And the Greek that was here flows right with this, so it's a good definition of it. To revere, to respect, to treat with deference and submission. You know what deference is? Deference means if we have a disagreement, I defer to them. Treat your parents with deference. Honor them. To revere, to respect, to treat with deference and submission. And then to perform relative duties to, which we talked earlier in that question. What are those duties? It also means to reverence, to manifest the highest veneration for. It means you just think highly of them and you speak well of them. And you venerate them, much like you would anybody who has earned a high respect. That's how you do, in words and actions. And so how do you speak of your parents when you are in other places? It's to dignify them, to elevate them in rank, and then finally to treat them with due civility and respect in the ordinary intercourse of life. And I look at that definition and I say, okay, all of that's there, and God says, do this. In relation to your parents. And I know this is tough because there's so many times when, as young people, we think our parents are just old fashioned. Our parents just don't get us. Our parents just don't understand the way we do things here in modern times. I remember feeling like that. But God doesn't say honor them unless they just don't get you. Then you don't have to anymore. Honor them unless they say something unkind to you. Then you don't have to honor them anymore. My Bible says honor. And I believe in every way across the board. That should be your go-to consideration as to how you're going to live and walk out a life of faith with God. And I know some of you come from difficult situations. I talked to one young lady here who doesn't have Christian parents, and that's difficult. What should you do in a situation where you don't have Christian parents? And I'm going to say there's another biblical principle that needs to inform how you're going to balance these things. And that's when I think it was the Apostle Peter, one of them said that we ought to obey God rather than man. And that was when the Pharisees were trying to tell them that they couldn't go preach. Well, God had said, go preach. But that principle that we ought to obey God rather than man comes into play and has to be put into perspective with this. So while you're called to honor your father and mother and lift them up and do what they say, if something they're asking you to do actually requires you to disobey God, then I do believe you're required to obey God first. But you've got to do that in the context of respect to the greatest extent you possibly can. But I think there's precious few of you young people here that are wrestling with parents asking you to do something that is ungodly. I think it's very likely that there's many of you here that wrestle with doing things that your parents would want you to do because you just think they're stupid or they're old-fashioned or they're way too strict or whatever, whatever, whatever. You have 1,000 reasons why, and you can live in another world. I'm saying God calls you back to a life of faith, where you honor your father and mother. Brother John the other night told you he has an assignment for you. Go home and tell your parents that you're sorry. I'd like to double down on that. You want the blessing of God in your life? Do you want all of these things that can come to you as a reward of faith? And we'll look at some of that tomorrow. Take these things serious. And just go home and bow your heart before God and your parents. And say, you know what, Dad, I want to give my heart to you. Because I recognize that God, the God I want to follow, the God I want to serve and live for, has put you in my life as my father. Doesn't matter if you're not perfect. I want to give my heart in submission to you. I can tell you this one thing alone, young people, is going to solve so many issues in your life. It's also going to make the job of your preachers infinitely easier. Because God ordained that your parents be the ones to give you direction in a lot of practical ways. So can you take it serious? And I'm out of time. I'm going to just pick up on some of this tomorrow. And we'll get to some of the rewards at the end. But I want to talk about courtship and marriage. That's such an important one, and it flows right out of this. I'd like to talk a little bit about sports and entertainment and how does faith inform the way we live. And maybe a little bit about the clothes you wear. But honestly, if you get the one right that I just talked about, that's going to take care of itself to a large extent. Maybe cars you buy. How are we going to live by the rules of the kingdom? So we'll look at some of those things tomorrow. And then I'd like to wrap up by looking at the blessings that God wants to pour upon your lives as you choose to live a life of faith. But my question for you in closing today is, are you willing to be serious? This isn't a head game. This isn't just something we talk about here and then go on with life. God's asking for serious reality in your life. Are you willing to be an example of me? Are you willing to be my image bearer here on earth? And if all of you young people will take up that challenge, it's going to transform the churches where you come from. So God bless you to that end. And I'll look forward to tomorrow. I'll turn it back to the brothers.
Thank you for listening to this message. We trust that it has been a blessing to you. If you would like additional sermons or a catalog, please visit our website at effortministries.org. Call us toll-free at 855-557-7902 or write to us at Ephrata Ministries, 400 West Main Street, Suite 1, Ephrata, Pennsylvania, 17522. You are welcome to copy this message for free distribution. This ministry is supported by your donations. May the Lord Jesus bless you.